This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Indiana ranks in the middle of the country for its hospitals' safety grades. About one-third of the 59 Indiana acute care facilities that were recently surveyed by the Leapfrog Group got A's. That's in a report that came out today. And Leapfrog spokesperson Erica Mobley says that the report is designed to help provide patients with information about how to protect themselves when they're visiting a hospital.
So the hospital safety grade is designed to measure how well hospitals are able to protect patients from harm and error in the hospital.
Johns Hopkins University researchers are reporting hospital errors are the third leading cause of death in the United States. The Indiana Department of Health is not going to comment on the reports from outside groups, but the state agency has a full consumer report on all of the Indiana hospitals available on its website. It's hard to believe that it's been more than 2 years since the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation decided to give one of the city's challenge grants, in fact, the very first one for the city of Gary, to an organization of people that got together with a vision that was created by a gentleman named Theaster Gates. That vision has turned out to become Art House, a Social Kitchen. It's in operation in downtown Gary, and we've continued our series of conversations with people who have been involved with the project. Now with Isis Ferguson, who is one of the originators of Art House, a Social Kitchen, and she's on the phone from Chicago area. Isis, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Hi, it's my pleasure to participate.
Boy, is it hard to believe that so much has happened in such a short period of time, and maybe it's a tribute to the fact that once people have an idea going, that all you have to do is wait for the support, financially as well as morally supports, I suppose, to get this project going. Will you please take us, since you're one of the folks that helped originate the idea, take us from the beginning. Tell us where Theaster Gates kind of fits into the picture, because we've heard a lot about him. And of course, he was one of the people mentioned very early on when the Knight Foundation had mentioned the finalists for the city's challenge grant.
Yeah, I'd be happy to take you through this last year. We've really mostly demonstrated the possibility of what can be done when people get together and they have a shared vision. So in its debut year, I think what Art House has done is really made a name for itself and for the city of Gary. It's kind of like a reemergence and a reminder that culture and art are important drivers of community development, and they can't be left out of city plans. There's some really visible accomplishments related to the space and to transformation and build out that most people can see when they drive by. Mm-hmm. So last November, you mentioned we're coming up on our one-year anniversary. Last November, 400 people came out for the grand opening. Those people saw the first phase of the artistic intervention on the exterior, and that was with the Light Lab piece of work. It's the Ripple and Wilson lantern installation. But inside, behind closed doors, behind those walls, work was never stopping. So during this last year, design attention was focused on the interior, and you've asked me sort of where does Theaster fit into this. This is squarely where he fits in. So the space underwent some aesthetic enhancements and some practical enhancements so that the facility adapted to the new needs. And Theaster's the artistic director for Art House, and he leads the vision for the artistic footprint in the building and sort of just the aesthetic. And so he downplays, I think, his impact, but the decisions that he makes are really remarkable, and so are the results. And so there's now a beautiful bar inside of Art House made of reclaimed African wood, local and regional ash, and a stock of old growth trees. All of this wood went into the bar. It went into a trellis that hangs from the main entrance, and a really dramatic floor-to-ceiling room divider. And he said, you know, in his sort of humble way, we simply tried to be good stewards of the space. It needed to be muted so that the space could shine, and now it definitely does. The floor is bright red. It is a statement for sure. But the building, at the end of the day, is just a structure. The people and what happens inside of it really make a space a place and give it meaning. And the staff, which is a really small staff, I don't think people understand that, the staff have done an incredible job in the last year to offer a variety of weekly programs and special events that have resonated with people's interests and needs. And whether folks are coming to learn how to better define their food product for a niche audience, and when I say coming, I don't mean like coming from just blocks away, like coming all the way from Indianapolis or they're traveling to figure out, like, how do you set up a website for your catering business, or how do you make a connection between poetry and baking, which is an actual session that we offered in the Culinary Exploration Series. One of the things that's really clear throughout all of that is that Gary can be and is an epicenter for learning and innovation and experimentation and entrepreneurship. And I think that really flips the stigma of Gary on its head. You know, mm-hmm. Fifth Avenue, downtown, has become a destination again. An art house, through really modest art moves and some focused and thoughtful programming, is generating real heat and magnetism.
We noticed that art house, a social kitchen, helps fit in as well as the U.S. Steel Yard, not very far away. They're on Fifth Avenue. To get people to come down to downtown, Gary, and to look around and to spend some time downtown. Obviously, it's nice to have that big ballpark not far away, because people come by and maybe they might be going to the baseball game, but this way they may swing by, I suppose, afterward if there's a function going on that they can attend if it's public, and they'll be able to find out more, not only about Art House itself, but also a little bit more about how the city of Gary is responding to the past and making plans for the future.
Absolutely. We're sort of happy neighbors right across the street. It's a busy street, but we do each want to lure the audience of each of those places over so we can kind of introduce folks to something new.
You mentioned briefly here about the events that have happened, and our past conversations have gotten into a little more detail about such things as the Culinary Incubator program, and in future conversations we'll talk with some people more about that, as well as the art gallery, which is something in particular that had been brought up here not long ago in a conversation. These are such great ways, and rather disparate, but they are very, very integral, as you've kind of mentioned, to the success of Art House, as well as to a way to bring people into downtown Gary. Do you think that we're going to see more expansion? Is there anything in the future that we haven't necessarily looked to that we might be able to look forward to?
Definitely. So we're gonna for this next year really stay the course, but at the same time iterate and innovate on some of the ideas. And we want to think about how we maintain momentum that we've built over the first year, but steadily grow and continue to be a good neighbor and a good steward of downtown. And so the CBI is absolutely a part of that. We've had two core cohorts of food entrepreneurs graduate from the Art House Culinary Business Incubator, and that's almost 40 people who've received individual and group support to transition through all phases of business development. It shows that there's so much talent in Gary and the region, and it speaks to the way that Art House is here to provide and create platforms for that talent. And so we're going to continue with that. Staff have an interest, at least some sort of beginning ideas around creating a junior CBI. They've tossed that out there to think about what it would mean to get some young people involved in the business and both the cooking side of food entrepreneurship. And then, you know, we're going to continue with the amazing weekly and special events that we've had that really aggregate talent from all over the region. We have folks who've participated in the CBI that can come back and be experts in programs for other people. So we're really trying to close the loop on that learning.
We're talking with Isis Ferguson, who's one of the originators of Art House, a social kitchen in downtown Gary. It's past the one-year anniversary of the grand opening, and looking ahead to the future, we'd be remiss if we didn't mention how city government fits into this, too, because they are a very important part of helping the project. I know they, in turn, helped sponsor the project as it came up before the city's challenge crew to look at how important the idea that the Astor Gates and everybody else, including yourself, I'm sure, that have helped work on this project in the past. Where does City Hall seem to fit in now, and how are they going to be able to help in the future?
They're working right lockstep along with the other collaborators, and I think one of the most interesting parts about Art House is the way that we can look and demonstrate what successful municipal, artistic, and community collaboration looks like. So we've been working very closely with Gary's Redevelopment Commission, very closely with the Economic Development Corporation, and we'll continue to do that in this next year.
How much satisfaction do you think people are taking, those not only the staff, the small staff that you mentioned, but other people who've been working so hard on this project over the last couple of years or so? How much pride do you think that they have now in seeing what's happened and seeing the response from the public, from the community, about Art House, the social kitchen?
I know if we all weren't working behind the scenes, we would be natural patrons of Art House. I think this far exceeds the hopes and dreams that we had going into this 2 years ago and then a year ago in the grand opening. I think we're delighted to see that it is resonating and opening, you know, pathways to success for so many people.
Well, do you think maybe that might be a good thing to be so close to it? You're not taking a look at the big picture, obviously, but you're seeing it every single day.
Absolutely, yes.
We talk about some of the ideas coming up in 2018 and the like here. Does Theaster Gates, since he helped with his vision get this thing started not long ago, does he have a chance to check in with you all and find out how things are coming along and offer any ideas?
Oh yeah, he's not far away. He keeps his hand kind of on the pulse of the work. Mm-hmm. And so I'm glad you asked about Theaster's role, because in 2018 and as we close out 2017, we're looking to activate the adjacent lot next to Art House, and that's a real opportunity to bring some synergy between the current indoor programming and extend that outside. And so Theaster's working on two pieces of artwork that will be installed on that vacant lot so that by springtime, when the weather's better and the temperatures are hotter, we can gather outside, have a celebratory moment, and really open that as Art House's patio and an extension of the exciting things that are happening outside. And so Theaster's absolutely a part of that work.
That's great to hear. And certainly, even though he may or may not be a baseball fan, since you're right across the street from U.S. Steel Yard, and you'll have all these baseball fans coming over after a Railcats game or maybe before a game starts, so come over and enjoy some of the opportunities that you save there outdoors. And it's a nice day out there, a nice day to sit and watch a baseball game, a nice day to participate at the Art House.
It's a perfect connection. Food and art and sports go together really well.
The only other thing I'd like to ask of you is to talk a little bit here about your role in this and how you're working with the staff these days in seeing that the things that were dreamed up not many years ago have become reality today.
Sure. So my title is the Associate Director of City and Community Strategy for Arts and Public Life at the Arts Incubator in Washington Park, the neighborhood in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And so you've articulated it perfectly. Many people make Art House happen. Some of us are on the front lines and visible, interfacing with communities and organizations. That's not exactly my role with Art House. I'm part of the unseen administration, sort of wrestling with strategy and ensuring vision and scope are maintained. But I am, like you mentioned, a day oneer. I've been around since the writing of the two grants to secure funding for Art House from Bloomberg Philanthropies and from the Knight Foundation. And, you know, in some ways, it's not important that every letter that we penned in those proposals is followed to a T. I think we would be doing a disservice to Art House if we limited its vision and sort of limited the organic way it's found to unfurl itself and said, well, we didn't say we were going to do this in the grant, so we need to not, you know, pursue this opportunity, or we said we wouldn't do that until the second year. Even though I'm part of that initial visioning, it's really good to sort of step back and loosen some of the reins and see where the project just naturally needs to progress.
But is this to have somebody that has the framework in mind, and that's what you and everybody else that got the project started have put together, and that's what you get to say. This is the skeleton, and we're fleshing it out with all these great programs and all the people that are involved in the projects, like the Culinary Incubator Program and all the things that you mentioned, that the art gallery itself, what Theaster Gates wants to bring to the table again in 2018, and anything else that may come up in the year ahead, I suppose.
Absolutely. We provided sort of those initial ideas, and we're open and flexible to what naturally sort of happens.
Well, Issa, I really appreciate you having time to talk with us to talk about this and following through and finding out a little bit more of the inside of the thoughts behind the folks who helped originate the idea of Art House, a social kitchen in downtown Gary. Mrs. Ferguson works very closely with the folks at the facility in Gary, and we thank you for taking time to talk with us today about it.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
You're welcome. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio.
Program support comes from NIPSCO. Leaky faucets are annoying, but not as annoying as wasting money. Visit NIPSCO.com/savemore to find simple projects to improve efficiency around the house. Join Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and the League of Women Voters of the Calumet area for a community conversation as we discuss the impact of women in politics here in Northwest Indiana at the Crown Point Library on Monday, November 6th at 6 p.m. With a panel discussion moderated by regionally speaking host Chris Nolte, we'll explore the positions and roles of women in region politics. The panel includes State Representative Linda Lawson, Vice Chair of the Lake County Republican Party, Dana Dumizich, and President of the Lowell Town Council, Leanne Angerman. Join us Monday, November 6th at 6 p.m. at the Crown Point Library or listen live here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org.
Coming up this next weekend, we were going to have an opportunity to witness the afterlife. Well, it's a play anyway that's called Afterlife, and they have people that have chosen that play for the latest performance for the Theater Northwest. IU Northwest is with us. We have with us seniors and actors Joshua Keim and Elizabeth Ramos, along with the director of the performance, Professor Mark Bayer, with us. Thank you all for being with us on Regionally Speaking. And I'll kind of open it up to either you, Joshua, or Elizabeth, whoever wants to take the question first. What got you attracted in this particular play, Afterlife?
The reason that I chose the play is I feel like a lot of people can relate to it. It's a show about grief. And, I mean, everyone has been there and, like, are learning how to deal with it. So I feel like this show can really touch someone in a way that they've never thought about before.
Now, since since you and Elizabeth are both acting majors, hoping to get to your degrees here very soon, was it this type of performance, this very emotional performance that drew you into the play?
I think so. Along with the emotional aspect of the play, the character I play is also different than a lot of the characters that I've played in the past. So I think being able to tell a story like this in a way that I haven't done before was really interesting to me.
Now, it's very appropriate that this particular performance should be coming right after Halloween. Is that one of the reasons you think that attracted you to the topic, other than the fact that you thought it was going to be a very great challenge to be able to perform?
I think it's just a coincidence that it fell with Halloween.
You would have done it any other time of the year anyway. It was because of the type of play that it is, I suppose.
Yes, definitely.
Now, tell us, if you will, what roles you two are going to be playing in Afterlife when it shows up on the stage here starting this weekend.
Well, I'm going to be playing Danielle.
And I'll be playing Connor.
Tell us a little bit about your characters, if you will.
Connor is Danielle's husband, and his character is more active. Going back to our house for the first time since the loss of our son.
Mm-hmm.
And all I want for us is to kind of work together to get past what has happened. And so throughout the play, my character sort of tries to get Danielle to kind of work with that grief and sort of find a way to get past it.
Elizabeth, what chose you to take the role that you're taking?
My character, she still is, like, heartbroken over her son passing away. He just passed away a few months ago. And it's really hard for her to come back to the house where everything happened. So it's just a journey of her trying really hard to deal with the grief, but it's still, she can't get past it.
Let's bring Mark Bayer into the conversation now. Mark is the Associate Professor of Acting and Directing there at IU Northwest, and he's the director of this particular performance. Mark, you've heard what your couple of your leads have to say about this. What seemed to be attractive to you in taking on this play as a project?
Well, it's interesting. I'm the father of a 4.5-year-old. I am painfully aware that before I was a father, I might have been insensitive to my parent friends on the subject of stories about children that were, that had some harm come to them. As a parent now, boy, stories like this that are about losing a child are really hard for me to grapple with. And so this has been a challenging time in rehearsal. I think Josh and Elizabeth saw this as a acting challenge, and I saw this as a really difficult emotional topic. I've enjoyed being able to bring us all, I think we're all working to tell this story in as truthful ways as we can.
We should mention that the performances for Afterlife are going to come up here starting on November 2nd, continuing on November 3rd, 4th, and again on the 9th, 10th, and 11th. And the performances, of course, are going to be on the stage there at the new facility in IU Northwest. What do you think that you find in this new stage, this new theater that you're going to perform in, that's going to perhaps help you or give you some incentive, do you think?
Well, the new Arts and Sciences building here on the IU Northwest campus has two performance spaces, a 500-seat main stage space and a flexible studio theater. And this Afterlife will be the first production in the new studio theater. It's a studio theater because it's completely flexible. We can arrange the audience in whatever way is best for the type of story and the type of production that we're doing. And we can bring the audience in a really intimate relationship with the stage, just like we did in our Grant Street temporary location.
That's great.
And so this production is using a lot of the new theatrical technology that we've been gifted with, including a tension wire lighting grid that allows us complete lighting flexibility in the room, and a really state-of-the-art sound system that we're utilizing to create some of the kind of chills and thrills in the show.
Well, Mark, it sounds like you are, all the others are going to be very excited to have this opportunity to put on the first performance in the new studio theater. And I'm sure that Elizabeth and Josh, I bet you both are probably excited too. You get a chance to rehearse in this facility and get to do your first, knowing that you're going to be doing the first performances in it. It has to make you feel pretty good.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely.
This is their last semester, so they have one semester of the new building.
Ah, very good. Josh Rakheim and Elizabeth Ramos are the leads in this play coming up, which is called Afterlife. It's going to be performed starting later this week at the Theater Northwest, which is the performing theater for the IU Northwest campus. And we appreciate all of you, including you, Professor Mark Bayer, for talking with us to talk about this. And the best of luck with you and the performance coming up.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our series on the ports of Indiana first went to Burns Harbor, which is, of course, an international maritime facility in the heart of steel country. 4 hours down I-65, the port of Jeffersonville is less a port and more of a manufacturing hub that just happens to be on the Ohio River. For the next part of our series, Indiana Public Broadcasting's Annie Ropeek talks about Jeffersonville as pushing ahead with expansions to cement its place as a port in the Midwest Industrial Corridor.
Indiana's three ports have a few things in common, chiefly grain and barges. Chuck Long of Consolidated Grain and Barge knows a bit about those. He's operations manager here for the huge international company, which collects grain from farmers and barges it to the Gulf of Mexico for export. Long says they also move products for other companies that live at the port.
So think of it as a cul-de-sac in a neighborhood, or the person that moves it around in the neighborhood.
His company is one of the port's stevedores. They pick up products and deliver materials on the roads, docks, and train tracks that connect this place. Soon, they'll have more room to do it. Jeffersonville is adding rail and barge capacity with the help of a $10 million federal infrastructure grant. Officials hope those upgrades will bring in more bulk cargo, stuff you count by weight. But for now, this locomotive is hauling the port's mainstay, steel. That's the business of nearly half the port's tenant facilities. Mike Pavick runs one of them, Michigan-based Mill Steel.
You're going right out that door there.
Yep. Pavick's factory barges in raw steel from the U.S. and beyond and trucks out finished products.
They can use it for furniture. It goes and gets stamped, and they can use it for different parts of auto parts. It can be used for a lot of different things.
Other companies here melt steel from scrap or clean the rust off it using acid. That's called pickling. And they all move their products in different ways, barges, trains, and trucks. Steel Dynamics, based in Fort Wayne, doesn't use the river at all at its Jeffersonville plant. But manager Chris Winger says they're still glad to be part of this neighborhood.
There is a portion of it that's a steel campus. It behaves like a steel campus, right? It just brings various synergies to that whole process of the steel market here in the U.S.
At Winger's factory, miles of steel coils are getting treated for use in construction.
So basically what we do is we take steel coils, right? We run them through a furnace, get them nice and hot, dip the steel in a bath of molten zinc. Comes out of the bath of molten zinc, we cool it off, make it nice and flat, we wrap it back up, we sell it to a customer, or we paint it. That's it in a nutshell.
From steel cargo that never touches the river to this barge being emptied of tons of fertilizer, Port Director Scott Stewart says all this probably wouldn't be here if so much of Indiana's border wasn't, in fact, water.
People don't understand. They think of Indiana as the crossroads of America, very ground transportation oriented, interstate highway oriented, but they don't think about Indiana as being a maritime state. Indeed, it is.
So Indiana may not be coastal, but having both land and water to work with can be useful. And Stewart wants his port to make the most of both. As it adds new rail and barge capacity, he says there's also a search for new tenants to complement what it already has. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Annie Ropeek in Jeffersonville.
Pre-kindergarten programs are expanding across the Hoosier State, including here in northwest Indiana now. And there's one program in particular, a very important early learning program that helps launch young residents in Hobart into good educational careers, when they're in school at least. The program is called Building Brickies. And this early learning program is under the supervision of members of the staff at the School City of Hobart. Laura Kovacs is the early childhood coordinator at the School City of Hobart, and she is with us today to talk about Building Brickies. Laura, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Tell us, if you will, a little bit about this new program and how important it is to get youngsters off to a good start. We're talking even before they even venture into kindergarten.
So important. So our Building Brickies program, which has been around since 2009, focuses solely on children who have not entered kindergarten yet. Hobart, School City of Hobart, has a wonderful focus and goal of having all of their four-year-olds in preschool. It's so important for them to be in a quality preschool before they ever go into kindergarten in School City of Hobart. So the whole focus of Building Brickies is a program that works with parents to empower them to be their child's first and best teacher. If parents are involved in their child's education and they have really great neurological information, they can really help their child be so successful when they get into kindergarten. So Building Brickies, we offer many components to families as they begin their journey towards school. One of the things we offer to families are home visits, where we visit them in the home and we show parents all kinds of ways through play that they can help their child reach all of their developmental milestones. We also offer monthly play groups here at the Early Learning Center at George Earl Elementary. We offer developmental screenings, possible referrals out to intervention services if that is necessary for children. If something is identified as being a potential delay, we put them into contact with like First Steps, NYSEC, things like that, so children can get help early on. We also have resource referrals within the community. And the heart of all of this in Building Brickies is school readiness. Mm-hmm. How can we work with parents so that their child enters school not just ready, but more than ready to learn?
Now, I understand that this program is patterned after a much larger national program. Tell us about that and how you all were able to adapt this national program to create Building Brickies.
We use the Parents as Teachers curriculum, which is a wonderful curriculum focused on children ages prenatal through kindergarten entry. And we are approved curriculum users of Parents as Teachers. We follow all of their standards as far as monthly home visits and screenings and all of that. And we use their curriculum to teach parents all about how to help their children achieve all of their developmental milestones, including language, cognitive, social, emotional, fine motor, large motor. And through that curriculum, it really helps parents understand how their child's brain optimally develops, how they can use certain times in their child's development and using play-based learning to really help them achieve all of their developmental milestones, which will really make them successful when they get into school. Parents of Teachers curriculum is absolutely wonderful, and we love using it.
Now, I imagine that even though you don't get into much of the medical terms or the medical details into this, but I'm sure that in the process, the parents get ready to know more about their youngsters' brains by learning a little bit how they basically work.
Another component that we've been using with in collaboration with School City of Hobart and our local preschools, as well as working with our families in the home, is we're using mindfulness curriculum to help parents work with their children so children can learn all about how their own brains are developing so that they can be telling parents that they understand when they're feeling strong emotions, things like that. So mindfulness is really helping parents, as well as preschool teachers, everybody involved in the life of a child's development, better understand how a child's brain develops and how we can best support them on their journey in getting ready for school.
I know that you have a lot of help and a lot of assistance from a lot of organizations in Hobart to help make the Building Brickies program so successful so far here. One of them is the St. Mary Medical Center, and I'm sure that there are staff members there that have helped you all in helping create this program so the parents know better, they can recognize certain things, like you say, learning a little bit about their youngsters' brains, the little details of that, but also, too, how they can take this information and turn it into learning exercises and other things like that, I would imagine.
Oh, St. Mary's Medical Center from day one has been such a wonderful support to Building Brickies, but they also provide so much wonderful support just to the School City of Hobart overall. Everything that they do to help all different aspects, including our early childhood program, they're such a wonderful referral for us. It's such a great relationship that we have built with them, and it's one that we value very much with St. Mary's. And they're, along with other organizations like Hobart Community Foundation, Hobart Educational Foundation, they're getting ready to have their big fundraiser. We're so excited to support them. So many local businesses that really get behind us because our funding does not come through the School City of Hobart. As we all know, education budgets are so tight. There's just nothing in the general fund that could support a program like this. Mm-hmm. So then we rely completely on grants like the one that we just received from the Legacy Foundation, through local donors, private citizens, businesses, and we also do our fundraising. In the spring, we always have Spring Fest, and the proceeds benefit our program. And through that collaboration of different funding that we receive, we're able to then provide all of these services to our families completely free of cost.
Now, as we know that the Indiana Department of Education and other related agencies down in Indianapolis are looking forward to the efforts to expand pre-kindergarten. We know they're working on trying to expand to three-year-olds and four-year-olds. Even with the pre-first grade and pre-kindergarten plans that they have they had any staffers look into the Building Brickies program to see how it works and see what they in turn can recommend when it's time to make some adjustments in the pre-K program statewide?
Well, we have met with people locally who are involved in that through our Ready, Set, Go program. We meet with mm-hmm. preschool providers themselves who work very closely with members from the state. And early on when that was all getting started and they were looking for local sponsors to get involved with that as well, we were involved in that. We are so supportive of making sure that every child can be in preschool by age 4, and it's something that we support completely.
Now, Laura, I have to ask you, what kind of reaction do you get from the parents that participate in Building Brickies and some of the other people that are involved in this, too? What have they told you? All of these exercises, the things that they have learned as parents and have been able to use in the program, what they've done for their youngsters?
The impact, we're not just focusing on the child. We're focusing on working with a parent. And when you work with a parent, that impacts generations. Parents tell us that they never knew these things before, and they're so grateful for the information that helps them to better understand their child's development, how their child's brain is developing, and they go and talk about it with their friends and their family, and the impact is so widespread. And these parents come to us, I mean, we just had our early childhood fair, and we had a parent come in, and we had the Lions Club there, another one of our great partners that we love to work with, and they're providing free vision screenings for parents. The parent came in, had no idea that there could be any potential problem with their child's vision. This child needs extremely strong glasses because of this, and it's going to affect so much of what the child is going through. Mm-hmm. Had they not just come to our early childhood fair, this child could be going into school with all kinds of vision problems that would just go undetected for so long. these parents come to us and tell us that this is literally changing their lives, and we are just so glad to be able to partner with them as they journey to get their child ready for school.
Well, that's wonderful to hear, because you always wonder if the, not only by the time the parents go through the program and their youngsters make it on to pre-kindergarten and even further along, if they've learned anything or if anything has resulted, like you say, that will help them make it through school that they wouldn't have had otherwise. Without this pre-screening and all the other events that you mentioned to find out about here, in particular with their health and in this case with the young person's vision. If anybody is interested in getting youngsters involved or grandkids involved in the Building Brickies program, who can they contact and what should they do?
If you live within School City of Hobart, and even if you don't and you want to find out about what is available to you in your community, call us. We will put you in connection with people that can help you, even if you don't live in School City of Hobart. Our phone number is 219-942-7263, and my extension is 8662. We get calls from people outside of our community all the time, and we love to put them into connection with their local resources as well.
We've been talking with Laura Kovacs, who is the Early Childhood Coordinator for the School City of Hobart, about the Building Brickies Early Learning Program. It's a program that gets young people, three-year-olds and four-year-olds, involved in working with their parents as their little educators, in a way, to get a head start in what they should know before they even get to kindergarten. Laura, thank you for spending time to talk with us about this. Good luck, and let's hope that the years ahead are just as successful as the last seven have been for Building Brickies.
Thank you so much, Chris.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The Indiana State Board of Education will approve School Corporation A through F letter grades today for the 2016-2017 school year. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Eric Weddle reports that more school corporations received an A this year than last year.
48 school corporations have been assigned an A on the state's A to F scale for 2017. That's more than double the number of districts that earned the top grade last year. There are fewer schools earning B's and C's than last year, too. 22 school corporations are also appealing their assigned grade. The state board will vote Wednesday on the grades. If approved, grades for each public school district will be released. I'm Eric Weddle.
We have an opportunity to take a look at the future now that we know at least that soon school corporations across Indiana will be learning what their letter grades are from the State Board of Education. But there are other concerns that school districts have, and they're looking to ways of being able to fund whatever their operations happen to be for the months and the years ahead. One of the school corporations in particular here in Northwest Indiana that is turning to patrons and to voters in their community is the School City of Hammond. The School City of Hammond joining that and the colleagues in Hobart in asking voters at the polls on Tuesday, November 7th, to answer yes or no to two public questions. And to find out more about the questions that the School City of Hammond is posing to its voters, we have Superintendent Walter Watkins. Dr. Watkins, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, not a problem. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. The conversation I had earlier with Superintendent Peggy Buffington of the School City of Hobart about the questions that they are offering to their voters in particular, one of the things that we brought up was to take a look at the issues that school districts, not here in Northwest Indiana necessarily, but everywhere in the state of Indiana, have to face these days in dealing with financing. And we've talked about this, I know, seems like forever, in the past, about how it's affected the City of Hammond School District in particular. If you will tell us, in this public question coming up, among the two that you have on the ballot, so to speak, that'll be considered for the residents on Tuesday the 7th, how does the operating expenses portion of what you have to work with from the state of Indiana fit into this particular question?
Let me begin, first of all, by letting you know that I have with me two of my colleagues here. I have Alicia Pritchett, who is the Executive Director of Business Services, and James Burgraff, who is the Executive Director of Building and Grounds. So we'll kind of play off each other in terms of getting answering these questions and getting the information out there that
that's
you're
right.
asking.
Thank you, and welcome to you, Alicia, and to James for joining us as well, too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, the operating referendum is the referendum that really will look at covering some important issues that we need in terms of staffing, in terms of bus transportation, in terms of bringing 21st century programs into our schools and educating kids for the future as they graduate from school. Alicia has a little bit of information about that, or far more information about that, since she is the kind of the one of the money people. Mm-hmm. So I'll let her respond to that if that's fine.
So basically what has happened in 2016, our school formula was changed whereby we received money from the state for two major categories in the school formula, which is the foundation and the complexity index. Well, when you hear that the state has given more money for schools, that is true as it relates to the foundation. However, what has happened, they have pulled money away from school districts who were getting the additional funding for the complexity index, which was basically the foundation basically pays for your normal school operation, general school operations. The complexity index helps cover the additional expenses that you need that goes over and beyond what's needed for general operations. Our district has been cut. Starting in 2016, we've lost over $3 million due to this change in the school formula. And if you compile that every year, you're looking at between 2.5 to 3 million every year of funding that the school district should have had, but because of the change in the school formula, we did not receive. That was one of the major factors in why, you know, where school districts are facing deficits in some cases because of the change in the school formula. And another reason is because of the change in how much the school districts are capped at receiving as it relates to capital project funds. Mm-hmm. In the school district of Hammond, we have over 20 buildings, and due to the state law that occurred in 2005 as to how much you could really receive from the capital projects fund, we were capped at that amount. But since 2005, you know, our school district basically expenses have grown because, you know, you're looking at more buildings, more expenses, you know, the buildings have got aged, you know, in over time. Mm-hmm. So that's another major reason. And you know, we look at the property tax cap that for the school city of Hammond, we lose over $2 million a year in as a loss due to the property tax cap that was put into the Constitution by the state.
I also know, too, that Lake County and St. Joseph County are going to be facing in 2020 a big change that will happen as a result of the caps that are put on taxes.
That is very true. So in 2020, the additional cap that, like for the city of Hammond, has been $1.18 that has been put on tax bills over and above the cap. That money that school districts and other taxing units in the city and in the applicable cities in Lake County and St. Joseph County will no longer receive those additional funds due to the waiver rules basically will expire in 2019. So in 2020, you're absolutely correct that additional funding for the exempt debt will be eliminated.
So I take it that you all feel confident that what you're asking the voters for in this first question that'll be on the ballot on November 7th will raise enough to be able to, at least you'll feel that you have the pad that you need to be able to meet the future expenses and not overtax anybody, literally.
Absolutely.
Okay. Let's take a moment here to talk about the second question, which is the one that seems to, it's almost as important as what people pay in taxes. It's the facilities, and you've talked a little bit about the age of facilities in the school city of Hammond, and in particular, one of the big issues that has come up here is the question about a possible bond issue, I should say, or a lease, depending on which, I guess, the school board feels is most feasible, to build a new high school. Give us an idea of how the high school stands right now, and what you're hoping for if the voters in Hammond approve this.
Well, this is James Burgraff, mm-hmm. Executive Director for Buildings and Grounds, and I'd be happy to address that question.
Thank you.
The the school city of Hammond has 25 buildings, and the newest new building is 10 years old already. So all of the other buildings are older than 10 years, and Hammond High School is 100 years old this year. And that building has been on the slate for replacement for many years, and it's just not getting any better. So that facility, it's already been decided that we would do something with it as far as replacing it with a middle high school facility on the same site. And And so we are we're looking at doing that, as well as making certain that we can do all of the other needed facility infrastructure replacements and repairs at the remaining 24 buildings throughout the district. And that's to make certain that we can maintain the taxpayers' investments, as well as make certain that these buildings are safe and conducive to the educational process.
So you're looking at you're looking at improvements, yes. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Before you go any further, let me say that I know you've heard two pieces of information that kind of conflict here. Ms. Pritchett said that we had 20 buildings, and Mr. Burgraff said we had 25 buildings.
All the 20 buildings.
Well, we have 20 school buildings, and the district has 25 buildings overall. I didn't want any of your listeners to say, they have different information.
There are other buildings that the school district owns and takes care of, which are not instructional buildings, I suppose. You're talking administration buildings and other buildings like that, facilities and things like that, true. And you're talking improvements to elementary schools. Maybe it might be a case where you may have to replace a boiler in a building or a roof or something like that. But all of these do cost money, and you have to figure these in if you want to make the improvements in the future. So this is all parcel of the overall capital improvement program, is it not?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. We have a number of things that we have to address at all of these buildings, and especially those that are older than 10 years. As you know, things wear out. Roofs wear out. The finishes inside of the building, meaning carpeting and flooring materials, those all wear out. But one of the things that we are always looking at is our ways of making certain that we have comfortable and efficient environments. And so our HVAC, heating, ventilation, air conditioning systems throughout the district require some tweaking in some cases and some full replacements in others.
Right.
So that kind of dovetails into that comment you said about boilers. Mm-hmm. But we also have chillers for chilled water during the summer months that are at their final legs and beyond as far as their longevity. So we have some things that we have some challenges ahead of us to get taken care of at all of our facilities.
And we're talking, according to the public question number two that's listed here, the maximum that you're looking at to be able to get the financing authority would be to about $110 million. And one of the things, if I may, I'd like to ask a couple questions as we kind of wrap things up here, is to talk a little bit about what kind of impact that the questions financially, if the voters approve it, will have on the average homeowner taxpayer in the city of Hammond?
So basically, the average home in Hammond is $80,000. So for the year of 2018, the additional, if the homeowner qualifies, and most residents do, for a homestead deduction, then taking that into consideration, mm-hmm. the amount of the annual tax, in addition to what they're currently paying today, will be $86.90. And that's roughly about a little over $7 more a month. In 2019, the annual amount that a homeowner will be paying in addition to what they're currently paying in this year will be $93.73. That's not a compounded amount. That's the actual amount that they'll pay in addition to what they're currently paying this year. However, in 2020, as you just mentioned, when the exempt debt rate goes is no longer applicable for homeowners, or actually all taxpayers, mm-hmm. then our rate is $1.18 for the city of Hammond. However, with both the capital and operating referendum, those two rates combined comes to 80 cents. So basically, it's like a 36 cent, I believe, difference between the what will be coming off of the homeowners' tax bills and what will be going on in 2020. So actually, taxpayers in the city of Hammond will actually see a decrease in their current bill in 2020 over what they're currently paying this year.
What kind
of... that's an example of how much a homeowner will be paying. And that's, like I said, that's the average assessed home value in the city of Hammond. Just if I want to go on the higher end, just say for about 20% of homeowners that might be at the higher end of a $150,000 home, that would be an additional $287.10 for the year of 2018 and $309.68 for the year of 2019. However, in 2020, again, the homeowners will see a reduction in what they're currently paying in this year over what they will actually be paying in the year of 2020. So the way I try to tell people is that just basically look at it as a five-year return on your investment. That yes, we're asking for an additional tax amount for the years of 2018 and 2019, but in 2020, year 2021 and 2022, you will have received actually that additional amount that we're requesting for 2018 and 19. That money would have been returned to you in the latter 3 years. So it's like a five-year return on the taxpayer's investment, you know, but again, you're adding on to the viability of the city, and it is an investment in the city, investment in the children's education. And one thing I would say for the school city of Hammond, we've held out on asking, going to our taxpayers, asking for money for a capital versus operating, whereby some districts are now at the point of asking for renewal on their operating or on their operating referendum.
Right.
We have not done that. There's 10 districts in our region that have already approved, where the voters have already approved either operating, capital, or both.
We have about a minute left here in the conversation. Superintendent Watkins, will you give us an idea from all of the number of public meetings that you've had talking about the referenda going back into September? What kind of reaction have you gotten from the public so far as we come up to the actual voting day on Tuesday the 7th?
Well, Jim, I'm sorry, Chris, this is my perception. You know, we started out of the gate kind of slow. It was a new process for us, so it was a learning experience for us as well. But I think here over the past 2-3 weeks, we've gained a lot of momentum, a lot of positive reaction, and some considerable support in what we're asking for taxpayers on Tuesday. So we're just trying to get the word out, talk about all the positive things that this referendum can eventually lead to, not only for the school city, but for the city as well. And I think we're beginning to see some dividends pay off for that.
And Chris, we do have our website that for any additional information, which is our website is www.hammond.k12.in.us. There is, and when you pull up our homepage, there is a section right in the middle of our homepage for homeowners, taxpayers to go to click on. It says referendum information, tells you about all the facts, all the financial information. We have the calculators out there so homeowners can put in their own home values to determine how much this will impact them. So we're really trying to be as transparent can be, you know, as far as letting our taxpayers know what would be the true impact and what are the actual facts as it relates to the operation of the district and the achievements that we have done in the school city of Hammond as it relates to academic progress and success.
We've been talking with the School City of Hammond Superintendent Walter Watkins and his top staff about the issues and the questions that have come up here as the November 7th referenda questions come forth to residents of the City of Hammond about what the school district is seeking from them. Thank all of you for being with us today to talk about this. We appreciate it, and we hope that our listeners have a chance to take a look at the information on the website if they have questions as well. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for being with us today. It's, of course, a Thursday coming up with the Means Around Reporters Roundtable Thursday, and we have some great stories that we'll cover from the reporters who worked on those. Hope you'll join us for that.